Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today I have the great pleasure of introducing Erica Victor. She is a clinical social worker at VNA Health in Santa Barbara, and she's here to talk a bit about her experiences in helping families, people deal with their struggles in taking care of people that definitely need to be taken care of. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
I'm going to let you, Erica, if you don't mind, talk about who you are and what you do, because as you can see, I'm going to mess it up. So go ahead.
I'm really happy to be here. Yes. So I'm a medical social worker in the home health department at VNA Health, and I've been there for close to 24 years. It's actually 27.
Wow.
if I count the first 3 years. And really the people I most closely work with are family caregivers.
And so, and what kind of care do they give to their loved ones?
It's quite a range, you know. I mean, some caregivers are in the home, taking physical care of their loved ones. Many are back and forth from their homes to their family members' homes. Some are even remote and flying in from other places for a week or two at a time and coming and going. It's anything from coordinating care, companionship, taking to appointments to actual physical care of the person, bathing, helping with toileting, dressing, and everything in between, medication management. And
how does someone become a part of your organization as a patient?
Oh, that's such a good question. So, we are referred to by a person's physician.
Okay.
Either out of the hospital or the other possibility would be they've been at a doctor's appointment and the doctor has decided, or the doctor's pretty familiar with what's going on. They call, a family member calls, and they order our services.
Oh, okay.
So we are ordered by, everything we do is ordered by a person's physician.
Oh, okay. So that's how the referral takes place. And yeah. I'm assuming that, is it mostly elderly or does it not necessarily?
So I would say, I don't know the exact statistic, but I think it's safe to say that 80 to 85% of our patients are seniors.
Oh, okay.
But we do see people of all ages in the home health department, because we're providing skilled nursing, physical therapy, occupational therapy. It's usually following an illness, an injury, a surgery, or a person's condition has recently declined.
Oh, okay.
And so we're going in there to see if we can help restore, rehabilitate, teach, to get them, improving, basically.
And recovering, improving. What is your specific role in all of this?
So my role as a social worker is to go in and see the patients and families that are in need of something in the situation. Okay. So it might be very practical things, extra care, meal delivery, transportation resources, hiring extra help, things like that. But it can also be to help with counseling, to facilitate, a person's adjustment, improved coping. Sometimes, we're seeing people who are pretty depressed, dealing with loss, dealing with adjusting to a situation that wasn't welcome.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what made you get involved and interested in this field? Yeah, so, I'm always curious about that when I meet a professional.
So just a bit about that. I became interested in working with people when I was at UCSB. I knew I was a psychology and sociology major. I took a class, a sociology class that I didn't really want to take, but I needed one more for my double major.
Oh, okay.
And it was the sociology of social welfare. Uh-huh. And it just sounded, okay, it's weird to say it now, but I was, what was I, 20 or so, 1920. And it sounded really boring, but I needed the class.
Right.
So it ended up being pivotal. The class was taught by a fabulous professor. I can see him, but I don't remember his name. Every week we had a social worker come in and speak to us from a different place where social workers work.
Oh, organization, that's interesting. Yeah.
Agency. And it really opened my eyes to social work.
Oh, I can imagine. I mean, how else would you know otherwise?
Yeah, good question. I realized that social workers can work in so many different settings.
Yeah.
So what a great area to go in.
Sure.
Not knowing yet maybe where I was going to want to work, that was a good place to go. So I ended up getting my MSW at UCLA. I went right from undergrad to graduate school. And the interesting thing about that was I was the second to youngest student there. A lot of the students I was with were in their 40s, 50s, having decided to go back to school after having raised their families. There was a lot of that.
Yeah.
Or seeking a career change.
Oh, okay.
Maybe they'd worked in a hospital setting or some kind of a clinic and saw what the social worker was doing and decided, I want to do that. So.
Wow. Was it weird to be the youngest person in the...
It was a little. I was grateful for the other person that was right around my age, but it was very different.
Yeah, I can imagine.
Very, very different. So at that time, now I grew up with a lot of elderly relatives. On my grandparents, both sides, lots and lots of siblings, so great aunts and uncles. And so I was around a lot of seniors growing up, and it was positive.
Where did you grow up?
Ventura County.
Oh, okay. So close by.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So you had a big extended family with lots of elderly people, and that was, it sounds like a good thing.
It was positive. Yeah. I had a positive, relationship with grandparents and great uncles and aunts and all of that. So I also had a sort of a negative experience in Girl Scouts when I volunteered at a nursing facility, and it was a little scary to be around people with severe dementia.
Oh, God.
I was a bit young and didn't really understand it and had a couple of kind of scary incidents. So I didn't think I wanted to be in the health and aging area of the field.
Okay.
I focused on, we had three tracks we could choose from, and I focused on child and family.
Oh, okay.
And when I got out of graduate school, I just wasn't finding, I was back in Ventura, wasn't finding what I wanted to do. And I was encouraged to go talk to the manager of the social work department at Community Memorial Hospital.
Oh, and that's in Ventura, California. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And when I met with him, I started feeling that this sounded very interesting.
Okay.
This area. So that's how I ended up, I got the job, and that's how I ended up in medical social work.
So you started in a hospital setting.
Right.
And what'd you do at the hospital?
Well, in the hospital, it's similar, only you're helping people get ready for discharge.
Oh, okay.
Letting them know, assessing really what they're going to be needing.
Yeah.
Letting them know what's available, helping them make those kind of plans. Also, very severe things. I'd be in the emergency room with a family if there was some, crisis going on. Same with ICU. So I was all over the hospital. I sort of had this continuum that I visualize when I describe what I do, because it's anything from very practical at one end to more psychosocial, emotional support, psychological support at the other end, and you can move up and down it throughout the day, within one hospital room.
Oh, I can imagine. I would assume that the family dynamics were very interesting to observe and interact.
Very much so. Very much so.
What did you notice as patterns that you think are significant to talk about?
Yeah, I think there's, in the early days of a new condition, an injury, an illness, it's very rough, for families to adjust to, sure. And the patient, of course, but kind of focusing on the family caregivers to come to terms with what's needed and how this is going to impact their life as well.
Can you give me an example, if you don't mind, like a concrete example?
Yeah, sure. We've recently had a patient, this is in home health, not the hospital, but where the couple, it was probably a couple close to retirement, were both working.
Okay.
And 60s, still working pretty hard. And he ended up getting severely injured and forcing her to stop working and take care of him. And just that, in some cases, lack of, resources in order to keep the same lifestyle going.
Right.
Is very, very difficult. And this
he
is
was injured on the job or?
This injury?
Yeah.
This injury was, I believe, in an auto accident.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So and it was, yeah. And
it wasn't employment related.
No.
Okay.
And not going to be able to return to work, clearly.
So he was injured that badly.
Okay. Yeah.
So she had to then take on the caretaker role.
She's taking on the caretaker role. They do not have the financial resources to hire, help in order to allow her to return to work. And finances really have such a huge impact on what's available to people.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
I wish it weren't the reality, but it is.
Okay.
And so those who, don't have the financial resources and are sort of in the middle group, as I call it, who aren't eligible for public assistance, et cetera, are sometimes the ones that struggle the most.
Oh, okay.
And, to adjust.
And so your work was not necessarily with the patient himself, but with the family?
In this case, much more with her. He was somewhat withdrawn. This happened to be a situation with that was Spanish speaking.
Oh, okay.
A bit of a language barrier. And I can use we call it the language line is an interpreting service that we use. And, I was focusing more on working with her around possible resources, possible ways of approaching the situation. They happened to own a home and the mortgage was almost as much as the income.
Oh dear.
And really struggling there. And I remember suggesting, it's very delicate, but suggesting would they ever consider selling the home and just changing to a different living situation? And that's when he chimed in, no, absolutely not. It was something so important to them. So
sure.
Yeah.
So I'm assuming that you saw her go through different stages of dealing with the situation. Is it the same sort of thing as when someone dies and they go through those specific stages of grief?
I think there is a lot of similarity when it's the process of adjustment, coming to terms with a new reality. So we do see, the denial phase. What we might see in the caregiving realm would be more family members who they appear to not be aware or maybe providing the care that is needed. Sometimes we see this with maybe a couple where one member of the couple is a caregiver. The other one has some kind of maybe a progressive condition. And what was needed for a long time, more is now needed. More help, more physical assistance, maybe more supervision. Maybe they really shouldn't be home alone anymore when it used to be fine to leave periods of time. And the caregiver isn't changing according to the condition of the patient changing.
And why do you think that happens?
Well, when you ask the question about, there could be some degree of denial.
Okay.
It also could be that it's just harder to see when you're living with it. Then, we'll come in from, we're a professional interdisciplinary team comes in and we can see more easily what the patient needs versus what they're getting.
Oh, okay.
We might wonder why the caregiver doesn't see it like we do. But I have my kind of theories about that, that it may just be that it's hard to see it when it's changing so gradually.
Oh, okay.
When things change so gradually. And so we can help, you know.
How do you help?
Well, we educate, you know, we all have our part. You know, physical therapy will want that family member to be a part of the physical therapy session so they can see, okay. show the caregiver what is needed now.
Okay.
Where the safety risks are. And I listen, explore just very gently, try to help the caregiver see what's now needed and validate, you know, that it's difficult to make these changes and to adjust.
And do you meet with resistance?
Oh, very much so. Okay. Resistance is definitely a challenge and something that's a part of a lot of what I'm working with.
And what? Sure. And how does it show? How does the resistance show itself?
Well, I think there's just a general human, you know, nature type thing about not resisting change. Yeah,
oh, okay.
It's a part of it. And a lot of times the resistance is also with the patient, the care receiver.
Right.
The patient, I'll refer to the care receiver as the patient just because of the nature of my work. There's definitely a tendency to resist change.
Right.
And even caregivers resist change when it comes to realizing that they need more help. More help is needed. And perhaps hiring help is needed. And I will often hear, but I don't want anybody else in the house.
Right.
I don't want anybody here.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want that. And so that kind of resistance. And
that coming from the patient or the caregiver?
Either.
Or both?
Oh, okay. Either or both. Yeah.
Yeah. So what is your approach under those circumstances? I mean, it's got to be difficult kind of trying to wake somebody up to a horrible situation.
So trying to, you know, a lot of reasoning, trying to paint the picture of what might happen if you don't get the extra help, how getting extra help may make a positive difference.
Okay.
I will often share with people that many people are in the situation they're in, and what I have seen is that things that are new are difficult at first, but people often do adjust and accept and even grow to really appreciate, whether it might be a hired caregiver coming in. There are, you know, people will say, I don't want a stranger in here. And I'll say, they're only a stranger in the beginning.
Right.
You know, pretty soon you get to know them and they're, you know, someone that you're glad to have as part of your situation.
So after denial, what comes next?
Maybe a little bargaining?
Well, I'm just wondering you see.
Yeah, something along the lines probably of, you know, let's just do this. You know, when clearly a certain amount of help or a type of help is needed, perhaps they're willing to do a portion.
Oh, okay.
You know, a portion of it makes some change.
And how do you handle your frustration with people that are making your job 10 times harder than it would be?
You know, I'm not task oriented, you know, and that's where, you know, my role is somewhat complementary to my colleagues who are healthcare professionals, nurses, physical therapists, occupational therapists. I think in general, and rightly so, are a bit more task oriented.
Oh, okay.
We have these things we are working on and we're trying to get the patient from this place to this place, level of functioning to this level of functioning. And while we can see that if you add A, B, and C, you know, home delivered meals, a hired caregiver, you know, that it will make all the difference in the world, but it's a process.
Yeah.
So I'm much more focused on the process. And honoring people's self-determination to make their own decisions.
Okay.
You know, applying pressure often only creates more resistance.
I would imagine so.
So really trying to help them, you know, we often talk about the goals of care. You know, what are your goals? What are you hoping, you know, I want to stay in my house as long as possible.
Okay.
I want mom to stay in their house as long as possible. Okay, that's a great goal. You know, what are we going to need to do in order to, you know, assure that that will happen? You know, what are the steps we can take?
Okay.
So sometimes just really starting to help them to also see that if we don't do that, then that goal is probably somewhat out of reach. And, you know, and it does happen. We will often see the folks that didn't get the extra help or whatever it is they need end up back in the hospital.
Oh,
they had a fall. They, you know, some other, you know, something went wrong. And it will often take repeated hospitalization sometimes before someone's a little bit more open to
needing. So it takes
help.
A bit of surrender on your part.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
Well, you know, and I'm navigating my role as a social worker and my role as a member of the interdisciplinary team at VNA.
Right.
So as I'm navigating that role because there can be competing priorities. So
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, you know, my colleagues, the team, may feel pretty strongly that something needs to happen.
Oh, okay.
You know?
Yeah.
Or the doctor. You know, we often get doctors saying something to the effect of, this patient, we need the social worker to help find an assisted living for this patient.
Oh, okay.
And that patient may not have any desire
to go to
any intention or be able to afford it.
So is that a lack of communication between the doctor and the patient?
I don't know.
You're not sure?
I'm not really sure. You know, I think it's more a that's just something that they hand over sometimes.
Oh, okay.
To, you know, the social workers, et cetera, who have all of that information.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what we're there for.
Well, it is true. I often ask people, there's a fellow I know right now who's facing a possible amputation of part of his leg due to diabetes. And I said to him, you know, have you talked to the social worker? He lives in Los Angeles, you know, to see if they can help you get some financial assistance to go on disability or whatever. He said, oh, I never even thought about that. And mm-hmm. I'm hoping I correctly sent him in the right direction because my assumption is that you guys are the ones that could help not just with his physical needs, but also with his financial situation.
Right. We are, you know, and sometimes what we're doing is letting patients and their families, their caregivers know that there isn't much help. You know, there isn't always help. It depends.
Yeah.
One of the hardest parts of the job is sort of letting people down when they had an expectation that Medicare would cover in-home help.
Right.
And then it doesn't.
So you are the bearer of bad news.
I can sometimes be the bearer of bad news. Yes.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
It's got to be really hard.
Not the easier part of the job, but it's also... But knowledge is power, you know. People need to know this.
Well, of course. And it's not your fault the government won't.
It's not my fault. It's true. And I commiserate with them.
Yes.
You know, I often say, you know, I really wish it were part of Medicare. Uh-huh. You know, some degree of, you know, a respite care or something along those lines. Might have not been such a bad idea.
Yeah,
you know, to do that, but that's not written into the program, at least not at this point in time.
Right. And do you also deal with patients that have dementia, or is it more?
Oh, sure.
Oh, you do. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Is that different than the other types of patients that, I mean, I know obviously dementia is different, but is your role different in a situation like that?
Yeah, well, when it comes to supporting and guiding caregivers, it's very similar. It's unique in its way.
Okay.
But, you know, and the reality is that we will have patients with dementia who we're providing services to for a different reason. Maybe they broke a hip.
Oh,
they've had
okay.
a hip replacement. Or
I see.
They're recovering from pneumonia.
Yeah.
Or, you know, whatnot. And they are getting our services. They might have a wound.
Oh, okay.
Nursing care that comes in and does wound care. So, and also a lot of what we do is caregiver teaching. That's a part of home health as well.
Oh, okay. I didn't know that part.
Mm-hmm, about
teach them how to care for their
medication management, understand, you know, what wound care and various aspects of a patient's care. A lot, that's the goal. That's part of what Medicare is expecting of home health, is that we're teaching the patient and or their family, you know, how to be more self-sufficient with their care.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So, but yes, dementia is often present in a patient, sometimes in a family member. Sometimes the family member is the person with dementia and the caregiver is our patient. That happens. Oh. And that can be really difficult.
I can't even imagine. How do you negotiate a situation like that? It's going to be really hard. Especially with the limited resources that are available.
Right, right.
I'm assuming that your heart is kind of broken on a regular basis with some of what you see. Is that a fair assessment?
It can be. It can be. But just like, I guess, when you do something long enough, you develop ways of coping and not getting pulled in too deeply into a situation.
So how do you take care of yourself in the face of taking care of other people?
Well, you know, I think I have my professional boundaries, which help. You know, I know where I end and they begin. And and my being there hopefully will be a bit better than not me having been there.
Sure.
You know, with whatever I can do to help educate, guide, support, you know, the patient family. Sometimes it's really giving a pep talk, you know, providing supportive counseling, which people need in that situation. So I know that I'm helping, you know, I'm making a positive difference most of the time.
Oh, okay.
So that...
That helps
that
a lot.
That helps, yeah. Sure. You know, It's life. It's what pretty much everyone's going to deal with in some way or another, whether it's themselves, their loved one, a parent. So kind of we're all in it together. And it's sad, it's more sad to think that somebody may not have, you know, professional support when they need it.
Right.
And they're going through that. So that helps. But yes, there are some days are easier than others.
Yeah.
Some patients and families are easier than others. And
boy, that goes without saying.
So there are certainly days when I, you know, probably need to take an extra long walk after work
or,
you know, do something in the realm of my own self-care.
You know, over the course of my career as a psychologist, occasionally I meet an elderly person who they have children, they may have lost their spouse, and boy, some of the children are just kind of just waiting for the person to die so they can get the money.
Oh yeah.
And it's so heartbreaking to me to see how cold and disinterested they are in their parent. Mm-hmm. Now, I can't say that happens in a vacuum. I'm assuming that if you don't care about your parents, they might have had something to do with it, but still, it's quite sad.
It is sad.
What happens when you encounter like adult children that don't get along with each other and have to make big decisions in terms of the, you know, caring for their patient?
A very frequent challenge.
That's what I'm imagining.
And in families that are dealing with aging parents, et cetera. Well, as you were mentioning, you know, sometimes it starts with my colleagues. I will often hear something to the effect of, I wonder why that son or daughter isn't more attentive, more caring. There seems to be tension. And, you know, the patient may be a very frail elderly person who doesn't seem to deserve that, who, you know, is worthy of care and, you know, tender care and all of that.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, my input is often, we don't really know the whole story here. There's probably a story that explains this. This elderly person wasn't always an elderly person. Once upon a time, they were a young adult, a parent, and we don't know necessarily what they were like as a parent. And sometimes I do hear what they were like as a parent.
Yeah.
I've often heard from caregivers, family caregivers, daughters, sons. I'm doing this because I feel morally obligated to, but I really don't want to be here. I've never had a very good relationship with my parent.
Right.
But I feel it's my responsibility to do this. So, you know, can't expect them to necessarily act in a way they don't feel. As long as they're doing a good enough job, you know, taking care of their parent, maybe it's okay.
And what about in a situation where all the kids want to help, but they have a different idea of what that looks like? And sometimes very much at odds with each other.
Very common, these kind of family dynamics. So I will offer to hold a meeting with all the adult children present, if that's possible.
You just became my hero.
I'll try, you know.
That's brave.
Well, the idea is to let everyone, just like in any group, right? You want to make sure everyone has a chance to express where they're coming from and why.
Yeah.
And, you know, then hopefully some education is a part of it. Well, you know, I understand you want your mom to have that hip surgery, but it sounds like the doctor doesn't feel she's a candidate and may not survive the surgery. Does that change? You know, this is what, you know, so just trying to really, you know, put the facts out there, acknowledge the feelings and where everyone's coming from. Sometimes there is a member of the family that has the power of attorney for healthcare. If the patient isn't able to speak on their own behalf, you know, effectively with their physician, et cetera, they actually have that decision-making, you know, responsibility.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily mean it's easy to do it when you're encountering all kinds of, you know, resistance and anger and opinions from other family members.
Right.
So you still want to, you know, people navigate that, some better than others.
Okay.
Some have no problem saying that. It's me. I'm making the decision. That's it. You know,
right.
Some have a much harder time. They don't want all that anger and tension directed towards them. An interesting thing I've observed is that often there's a child, let's just say an adult child, when there's 2, 3, 4, 5 or more kids, there's often one that's the most present, maybe living with their parent or nearby,
right,
doing most of the care, the transportation, the shopping, all of that. And there's then often others that are far away. Sometimes they're the most vocal, and the adult children who aren't present are sometimes the most opinionated, vocal about how things should be, which is really, really interesting and very, very difficult for that adult child.
Yeah, because they're not involved, but they're acting like they care.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of a general trend that sometimes has something to do with some maybe guilt. At play, they can't be here. Maybe they feel like they should be, but they can't, or they don't really want to be. So they overcompensate maybe from a distance and try to be more involved, you know, in a different sort of way. It's kind of interesting.
And what do you do in a situation like that?
Depends on the situation, but I give that caregiver that's present a lot of support.
Okay.
Try to empower them, you know, to deal with that.
Uh-huh.
And I'm always offering to talk to the family member that's at a distance. Sometimes just hearing them out, giving them support for their concerns, et cetera. So
I worked with an elderly woman once who was quite wealthy and lived by herself and got to a point where she couldn't care for herself. And she had 3 kids, but they were completely uninterested in her welfare. So she found a couple who came to live with her.
Mm-hmm.
They were men, and they took really good care of her. And she actually developed a really strong bond, probably stronger than with her own children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That can happen. Yeah,
and she got too infirm to be able to make it up my stairs, and so she would send a driver to come and pick me up to go to her house. And what she asked me to do was to be willing to testify against her children because she was going to leave $500,000 to the caregivers, and she knew that as soon as she died, that the 3 kids would come and do everything they could not to honor her gift. So she set it all up, you know, the way that she wanted to with her attorney. And then after she died, her attorney called me up and said, you know, as the mom expected, the kids were, you know, contesting the situation. Would I be willing to testify that in sound mind she said that that's what she wanted?
Right.
I said, sure, happy to do it. And then the children backed away.
Oh, okay.
Now, I tell you this story only because I'm wondering if there are times that you have to get sort of involved in a situation mm-hmm. where you encourage the patient to get an attorney to make sure mm-hmm. that, you know, their desires are mm-hmm. are well met, if that
definitely.
Makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. Certainly. I'm often referring to estate planning attorneys.
Oh, you do? Okay. Mm-hmm. I wasn't sure about that.
Yes, and also to private fiduciaries.
Oh, okay. Yes.
I can think of a situation where one of our patients, her daughter was living with her and was taking care of her kind of okay, but was spending the money.
Yeah.
Just carte blanche, you know.
Absolutely.
And the very frail elderly woman, to me, had all her wits about her, and uh-huh. she had very valid concerns. And I was able to link her to a private fiduciary in town who came in and helped her rearrange some things and then took over, you know, managing her accounts or whatnot. Right. And I think the daughter got some kind of an allowance and wasn't very happy about it. But I remember it working out quite well.
Okay.
Exactly what she needed, you know.
Do you ever have to get adult protective services involved?
Oh, yes. I'm a mandated reporter.
I figured
like
that was
all of
the
us
case.
In, you know, healthcare and mental health care are.
Yeah.
And I've made numerous, you know, reports over the years. So it's an interesting thing with APS. So, you know, we're mandated reporters.
Yes.
I'm a mandated reporter. So there's times when it's just clear. I have no choice. I need to make a report.
Can you talk about what that actually is? Because I don't know if a lot of people know what that means.
Yeah. So by law, anyone in healthcare or mental health care, and I think in other certain contexts as well, if abuse is suspected, we are required by law to make a report to Adult Protective Services.
Right.
We, in an abuse, whether it's physical or neglect, you know, emotional abuse, financial abuse, sexual abuse.
Right.
We, in a way, the mandate is, in a way, it's kind of a gift because we don't, it's really not up to us.
Right.
We have to, it doesn't make it easy necessarily, but it makes it clear.
Yes.
That we need to make a report in certain cases. You don't have to have proof. You have to have just reasonable suspicion.
Right. And you can't be held accountable legally for filing a report.
Right. That's true because it's confidential.
Right.
The reporting party is confidential. You can waive the confidentiality, but it's otherwise confidential.
Well, but even if the family figures out who made the report, which is sometimes fairly obvious, I just want people to know that they cannot be held legally.
Right.
You know, you can't be punished for filing a report.
Right, exactly.
And that's important.
Exactly.
Otherwise, it would be really scary to file a report.
Yeah. So my approach with APS, Adult Protective Services, is, you know, when it's, sometimes it's a clear-cut case and I have no problem making a report.
Right.
When at all possible, though, if I feel it's safe and it's clinically a good idea, I will let the patient or care and or caregiver know that I'm needing to file a report and this is why.
Oh, okay.
You know, there's cases when I haven't, but I try to whenever, you know, especially, you know, if they are likely to figure it out, that's one thing, somebody from our agency or whatnot. But I also feel like it can definitely force an important conversation, you know, and it just really kind of cuts through, you know, some of the maybe denial or whatnot that this is a problem, you know, what's going on, or a likely problem. There are times though when, one of the other things, so we're mandated, but sometimes there's this desire or sense that if we report to Adult Protective Services, the thing that we want to get done will get done. You know,
right.
It'll make the daughter place her mother in a care facility, or it will, they will for sure get help. But we can't expect Adult Protective Services to do any particular thing, because they have their own, you know, protocol and way of assessing the urgency or what their intervention will or won't be. So they open a case. Sometimes I'm grateful that I have good rapport with Adult Protective Services social workers. And we will, I will often confer about a case, which is really valuable.
I'm sure.
We can kind of help each other out. They're under no obligation to do that. So when that happens, I'm really glad. But they take a case and it's their case, and they decide what to do with it. And and their intervention is voluntary to the subject, you know, the potential victim. Can tell them to take a hike. You know, I don't want your services.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Because when it comes to child abuse, that's not the case.
No, it's different with child abuse.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's different. Because, you know, seniors, or it's seniors or dependent adults, are legally competent unless that's taken away.
Oh, I see. Okay. So they can say no if they want to.
Yeah, so they can. I don't know that they always know that.
Right.
The other thing about Adult Protective Services, sometimes I hear, if in doubt, report.
Yeah.
And I don't have that approach. I really want to be pretty clear it's the right thing to do.
Okay.
If I'm at all mandated, of course.
Yeah.
But that's not if in doubt. Then I'm not, really doubting that I need to.
Right.
I've seen that it can be very devastating to a family member who's really trying hard.
Yeah.
Who's really done, has sacrificed a lot. And is doing the very best they can.
Yeah.
When Adult Protective Services knocks on the door, it can be very devastating.
Well, it's one of those situations where you're guilty until proven innocent.
Right. And it doesn't help, you know, for your caregiver to be, brought down in that way, you know, so... Sometimes it just has to happen, and it just is. But
sure.
But I just try not, you know. Often when we're involved, we can help the situation. So if it's a gray area, we're not loving what we see. We're kind of concerned. It seems like there's really not much food in the fridge, or you know, if I can help arrange for some kind of meal delivery or somebody to help with grocery shopping. And maybe the specific concern can be addressed.
Yeah.
Then there's no reason to report it.
Right.
If I'm trying to help and it's met with, no, don't want that. Nope. Don't want your help. Go away. Don't want anything to change. And we're left with the same concerns that we had in the beginning.
Right.
Then maybe we feel there is a need to make a report.
Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah.
Do you work with children or only adults?
Yeah, you know, not many. We have had children on service. We sometimes do. It's pretty infrequent.
Okay.
You know, and I'm not necessarily called in if they're just getting physical therapy or some kind of nursing and that's being taken care of and their family situation's good.
Oh,
you know, they wouldn't necessarily need me. But I've definitely seen some children, teenagers.
Right.
You know, I've seen my share of teenagers that have been injured some way or another, and you know, the family is just looking for some kind of resource. Seen some pretty sick kids too.
Sure.
We often in home health, we are as much as our general mode is to be helping our patients improve, you know, get better, recover, we do have our share of patients with cancer and other terminal illnesses that are still in the stage when they're treating it.
So before they're referred to hospice.
Right. Yeah. So we do see many of the patients that are on hospice have been seen by home health.
right.
first.
Well, I know that when my wife was working at VNA, that she always volunteered whenever a child came on hospice. I could never understand how she was able to handle that. To help a child die is so far beyond my comprehension.
She has a gift.
She just, I mean, it was, she just knew that was her calling.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
But she talked to me occasionally about family dynamics that she encountered, and it was always really, really difficult.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I can't even imagine what it would be like if one of your children was dying or, you know, was really, really ill.
Right.
Does the feelings of family have sometimes get placed on you?
Oh, yeah.
I'm wondering if you've ever thought about that, because, you know, it's really common to get scared to death when something happens, and usually people take their fear and turn it into anger.
Right. Oh, sure.
And I'm just wondering how often that gets put on you.
Yeah.
Because they got nowhere else to put it, or they don't know where else to put it.
Yes.
Is that an experience?
Displacement happens for sure.
Okay.
I see it quite often. I don't know that I know it's been placed on me, but what I think often will happen is, we'll work that through. You know, if I'm telling the patient or family something they don't want to hear about, no, Medicare is not going to cover that, and no, there isn't really any free services for caregiving. I will often see anger, and, you know, the thing I hear frequently is, you know, I worked hard all my life. I paid my taxes. I saved it. Yeah. And this, you know, and there's nothing for me. I will just hear that person and some degree of, you know, commiseration about just the way the system is and how frustrating it is. So it just seems I'm usually able to help them work through that. So I'm not necessarily the target. It happens. I mean, there's some people that are just, there's not much you can do, you know, so you just do the best you can.
Yeah.
But I think doctors often get displaced upon and the system.
I can imagine.
And you know, I've had many people say, I'm not angry at you. I'm just angry at, you know.
Yeah.
So, but yes, there's people that are just angry. And so whoever walks in the room, they're going to feel it.
Yeah.
I had that happen real recently when I walked in and saw the patient. I went, oh, I can see what's going on. Very new cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
Somebody who had just a few months ago been doing fine.
Yeah.
You know, and I could quickly sense that I probably wasn't going to get a smile out of this patient, and that's okay.
Right. Yeah.
I could completely understand how devastating things are for them right now.
Sure. So what else am I forgetting to ask you about here? We've talked about a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering if there's anything you can think of that I missed in all of the...
Yeah, I'd like to mention that. So caregivers are often, I think, in a place where there's unrealistic expectations on the caregivers.
What do you mean by that?
Well, and maybe not just a full understanding of the caregiver and what's going on with them. So I want to say first that I just have the utmost respect for all the nurses and physical therapists and occupational therapists, et cetera, that I work with. Amazing. The focus tends to be on the patient and their well-being in home health and probably healthcare in general.
Uh-huh.
And that's fine. That's good. And that's where I'm glad that I'm a part of the team, because I can often see that the caregiver is struggling too. And it's really important to understand what they're capable of, how they're doing, and to weave that into what we can expect from this situation.
Oh, okay.
So I've seen caregivers sort of be maybe judged for not doing much or not always being home when they come, you know, or as soon as the physical therapist walks in, they leave to go do something because the way they see it is, oh my gosh.
We got 10 minutes.
Yeah, maybe even more, you know. I can finally go do that thing I need to do.
Right,
and they don't necessarily realize that the physical therapist was sort of hoping they'd be a part of that session or, you know, so a little bit of a disconnect there. So they're going through the situation too, and they're humans too. You know, they've got their, and some, not everyone's equally capable of being a caregiver. It's kind of a personality trait.
That's for sure.
Yeah. And so there's so many things at play. And I just think it's so important to I have a lot of compassion for caregivers.
A lot of compassion because
sometimes it's just a brand new situation that they were thrust into and they're doing the best they can.
Yeah.
And caregivers will sometimes, not realize that their health and well-being is equally important to their loved ones.
Absolutely.
There's almost like a common, I don't know if it's a belief or just expectation, that they put everything aside for their loved one.
Yeah.
And that their health and well-being now comes second. And I try to shift them out of that thinking.
Right.
Yes, in a crisis. Yes, in a crisis, we do have to put our needs aside and address what's going on, of course. But as a ongoing lifestyle, that's going to be detrimental to that person. And so my premise is that everyone in the family their well-being is equally important.
Right.
And so we need to find a situation that will provide care to the care receiver, but also honor and support the caregiver's needs as well.
Right.
So, somebody will say, I hired a caregiver on Wednesday so I could go to, go play golf. And I say, great.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so glad you did that. That's excellent. That's so important. You're to be able to still have meaning and enjoyment in your life is so, so important.
Yeah.
And different caregivers are often at different places with this, in terms of their ability to allow themselves to put their needs at least on an equal plane.
Do you see a difference in gender, in terms of way men and women handle the situation? Because I've had, sadly, a lot of pretty serious medical stuff I've had to deal with.
Yeah.
And everybody jokes around that I married a nurse. I didn't realize how important that was going to be later on in life.
Yeah, good job.
but the hardest thing for me as a man, and I know I'm old school, I spend my time helping people. Mm-hmm. I'm a giver, and I love taking care of people.
Yeah.
But lots of times people that give have a really hard time receiving.
True.
Right?
Oh, so there's that, yeah.
For me, receiving the care of my wife and my family, my children, in the past has been really difficult.
Yeah.
Especially as a man, super stubborn. And, all three of them, two kids and wife, have gotten really mad at me because, they say to me, God, you take such good care of us. We're just trying to take care of you. Right. Would you get over yourself and let us do it? And I had to learn the hardest way possible.
Yeah.
Because I've had a few situations where I actually couldn't take care of myself. Mm-hmm. So I had to surrender.
Right.
I can tell you that was not very easy for me to do, but I have since learned to do it, but I still feel guilty.
Yeah.
When my family wants to take care of me.
Right.
I don't know if I was a woman, if I would feel exactly the same way, or would I? Because I've never been a woman, so I don't know.
No, there's definitely people who have a hard time accepting help and people who have a very easy time accepting help and everything in between. But I do see that. And there's a little inside joke that nurses and social workers make terrible patients. They just don't want...
Psychologists, too.
Yeah, I'm sure, yeah. Yeah, there's many of us have a much easier time helping than receiving help. And, again, that's part of a process, and I'm often working with people to... So they're uncomfortable accepting help, reminding them that they're part of a give-and-take community. That's a wonderful thing.
Uh-huh.
Be part of a community, right?
Yes.
That we're not, I don't believe we've evolved, and maybe we never will, maybe hopefully we never will, as a species or whatnot, to be not ever in need of help. That's part of being human. Sometimes you need to help someone and sometimes you need to let people help you. And that's just a part of life. Uh-huh. And if there's somebody there that wants to help you, that's a great thing. And it's good for them too.
Well, I mean, I've said to people many times, does it feel good when you help someone? And generally speaking, unless you're a very self-involved narcissistic person, the answer is, yeah, I love it. It feels really good.
Yeah.
And I said, well, why would you want to deny the people that love you that same feeling?
Right.
So that's how I've been able to get past my own resistances, to remind myself it's not about me, it's about them.
Right.
Showing their love for me. And, and I'm kind of a, well, I'm a dick if I don't let them do that, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's been easier for me to accept help if I remind myself that I don't want to deny the people that I love and that love me. That same feeling that I get when I take care of them.
Yes.
Now, that might just be a grand rationalization, but it works.
Yeah, yeah, whatever works. Well, yeah, just letting it in, you know, but also understanding that that's not uncommon to have a general resistance to accepting help. You know, and again, there's so many different personalities, but some people have just been so self-sufficient all their lives.
Right.
Like the need for help may be a sign of something changing that they don't want.
That's
to
right.
be changing.
Or weakness.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
So maybe part of denial or bargaining or something like that, just pushing it away.
Right.
But I will work with patients and caregivers and say, you know, has anybody offered to help? Because sometimes they'll be looking for help from the professional realm or the community service realm.
Right.
Which is okay, but there's nothing that substitutes for help from your own support system, circle of friends and family, if it's there and it's okay, it's relatively healthy. There's nothing in the community service realm that can substitute for that or can be as good as that. So, you know, I will often say when your neighbor, your relative, your friend offers help, it's really easy. You say yes.
Yes. Yes,
say
thank you.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
Yes, thank you very much.
Yeah. But, you know, that's, you know, just, and, you know, we do it with a little bit of levity and acknowledging that it's hard, you know, but say yes anyway. It's good for you. It's good for them. And I'll help a patient or family member try to reflect on a time when they were helping someone. You know, I'm imagining you were that person once.
Right.
And maybe it's coming, you know, full circle to back to you in a good way.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but that is definitely you know, a real issue that people grapple with.
Sure. Anything else?
Gosh, I'm sure there is.
Well, we've had
this is a vast subject.
You know, Erica, you've been incredibly helpful and very eloquent in describing all of your experiences and what you encounter. I just can't even tell you how much I appreciate it.
My pleasure.
This is the beginning of a series. I'm interviewing some not professional people. You're the only professional.
Okay.
But I'm interviewing, there's a woman that is caring for, her mom had Alzheimer's and now her husband, which is really sad. And a few other people that are, you know, in the process of trying to do the best they can to care for others. So I wanted to find a professional person like yourself who could speak really eloquently about what you encounter. And I really appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure. It's been wonderful to speak with you.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We hope you enjoyed this podcast. Remember, if you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation to the Fear Me Out podcast, please go to www.jccs.org and earmark your donation to this podcast. If you need more information about making a donation, you can contact Dr. Saperstein directly at 805-452-0006. Thank you.